Everyone, welcome to Breakfast with the Florida House. Emma, please call the roll.
Chair Garrison.
Here.
Vice Chair Jacques.
Here.
Ranking Member Woodson.
Here.
Representatives Abbott.
Here.
Amnesty. Antone. Bartleman, excuse. Black.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Kennedy.
Here.
Mello.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Steele.
Here.
Trabulsi.
Here.
Quorum, Mr. President, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Emma. Quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to this morning's meeting of the Healthcare Appropriation Subcommittee. As we always do, thank you for your attendance, and we're glad everyone is here sharing this brisk Thursday morning with us, and we always will always want to say thank you to our sergeant staff for keeping us and our guests safe. Members, today we have two presentations from the Department of Children and Families and a third from the Department of Elder Affairs. We're going to handle the DCF presentations first. Our first presentation from the department is going to be an overview of the state mental health treatment facilities. Presenting for DCF will be Erica Floyd Thomas. Erica, good to see you this morning. Assistant Secretary for Substance Abuse and Mental Health, and also Tony Lloyd, who's the Assistant Secretary for Administration. Our second presentation by the department will be an update on homelessness funding, and will be presented by Jess Tharp, who's the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Community Services. And then our last presentation this morning is going to be an overview of funding for Florida seniors by Duval County's own Michelle Branham, the Secretary of the Department of Elder Affairs. Members, I really want to encourage every member of this committee to be engaged in these presentations. These are on the agenda because I want them to be on the agenda. I feel very strongly about these issues. I've been try to be very forward-facing in why I think this is important, specifically our state mental health treatment facilities. In a post-COVID world especially, we realize that there's a lot of folks who need a lot of help, all right, in these areas. And one of the core functions of government is to make sure we have services to provide hands up for those who truly, truly cannot help themselves. And those of you who have had folks with mental health challenges in your families, your friends, know that there is truly nothing more challenging for a family than having a loved one in severe mental health crises. And so we want to make sure we are doing everything we can as a state to provide those core services. I will also just say, from a matter of public safety, during my 10 years, I was able to serve as a prosecutor. I saw some tough stuff, but some of the most difficult things, cases I ever worked, were those involving folks who were a danger to themselves or others. Not because they were evil people, but just because there was something wrong. And we have an obligation to do everything we can to keep our citizens safe. And so specifically as it relates to our forensic services that are administered by the department through these mental health treatment facilities, we want to make sure that we are doing everything we can to make sure we're doing the right thing. Secondly, on the DCF issue, you'd have to be living in a cave not to realize that coming out of COVID throughout the nation, there have been challenges in the area of increased homelessness. Just driving into the office today, I've noticed in the last couple of years in Tallahassee, there's just more people out on the streets, often whom appear to have mental health or behavioral health challenges. So we are looking at, as a state, at ways we can kind of be proactive in this area. We want to give a hand up. We spent a substantial amount of money in last year's budget, I think an additional $16, $17 million, if I remember, Brian, supplementing the already significant investment we've made in our grants to different agencies that are assisting with providing homeless services. So we want to do a little bit of work today to see how that money is being distributed, how it's being spent, because we're going to continue to work on that issue this year. The Florida model for how we're going to deal with this is going to be different, and this is going to be an area of emphasis in this upcoming session. So I encourage your robust engagement, and thank you to the department for being here to present to us this morning. We really appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to be quiet and call up Ms. Floyd Thomas and Mr. Lloyd. Members, as they give the presentation, I'm going to ask you hold your questions to the end. We're going to have some time. I think, all told, we're going to try to give the better part of an hour to the department on these issues. So just kind of as you think through these things, that's a soft stop. But just understand, probably got about an hour. So judge your time accordingly. And you are recognized. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Garrison and Vice Chair Docks and members. I'm grateful to be here this morning, and I have the honor of serving as Assistant Secretary for Substance Abuse and Mental Health at the department. And as you just heard, we'll be talking about state mental health treatment facilities. And I'm joined here by my colleague, Tony Lloyd. So as you know, the goal of the department really is to make sure that we protect vulnerable citizens, a vulnerable population. So we do this by promoting prevention, strengthening our communities, making sure that we have services in place. As you know, we are the single state agency responsible for substance abuse and mental health and for opioids. And under that purview, we have the responsibility of our state treatment facilities. So I'll get into that with you. So the state mental treatment facilities are the most acute inpatient behavioral health services available. They are designed to provide intensive treatment to persons exhibiting violent behavior, suicidal behavior, and just severe disturbances due to their substance abuse or their mental illness. Within these facilities, we have a lot of clinical staff, as I've just alluded to, and other professionals that provide behavioral health services. We have two types of patients that receive care there that are established in Chapter 916 of the Florida Statute and 394. So currently, with Florida's population and its increased growth, and just the growing awareness around mental health services, our needs for all levels of care continue just to rise. So the state mental health treatment facility system is made up of six hospitals that are inpatient, of course. Currently, we're serving about 3,185 inpatient. We have 3,185 inpatient beds. And that breakdown of those beds is we have 79% of those beds are for males and 21% are for females. As you can see on the slide reference, we have our state mental treatment facilities throughout all regions of our state, so from the southernmost all the way up to outside of Tallahassee and Chattahoochee, and then, of course, right outside of Jacksonville and McClenny and down in Alachua and a couple of others that are located in Martin County and Palm Beach and Broward. So, throughout these six facilities, and they operate as this one cohesive system, we have a total of 73% of our beds are operated by the state, and we have two of the largest facilities, so largest hospital systems, the top 20 in the nation in terms of beds. And the hospitals that represent that are Florida State Hospital and our Northeast Florida State Hospital. 27% of our beds are managed by our vendor. In 2012, the state hospital had about 2,552 beds. And right now, like I said, we have 3,185 beds. So that's a total increase of 25% of inpatient beds that are available. We began our work in 2022 to decrease our wait list and to improve the system utilization through our throughput. And what we did is we increased and grew our bed count by 94%. So when we compare our fiscal years, we compare 2020 to 2021, state fiscal year, the department increased the overall forensic admissions by 44% and our civil admissions by 80%. And the other slides will kind of discuss what allowed us to drive to that increase. So admissions, many people ask all the time about how does one get referred or how do you get care at a state mental treatment facility? And there are two pathways to be able to do that. You receive a petition from the court, either that goes through from our 67 sheriff offices, or from one of our 120 designated state or receiving facilities. So these patients, again, have the highest acuity, and they have just an array of serious mental illnesses. And so just an overview of those conditions, it's usually like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, a personality disorder, severe depression, or just a co-occurring diagnosis, usually having suicidal ideations or threats of suicide. But our most common diagnosis that we have is schizophrenia. And second to that is bipolar disorder with psychotic features. And then third is mood disorder. So greater than 90% of our patient population is on an antipsychotic medication. And our average length of time to be able to stabilize a person on that medication takes between 4 to 6 weeks. So Chapter 916, so these are the patients that we refer to as our forensic patients. These patients, again, are referred through Chapter 916 by one of the sheriff offices. And so what that means is they've had an interaction with the legal system, with the law, that put them into the judicial system. So as they go through this process, they may have charges, but those charges have not been, they have not been convicted of their charges. But it's determined that they are incompetent to proceed in a court proceeding. They don't fully understand their actions or what led them to this. Many times they're in active psychosis, so not really coherent or completely lucid.
Members, so, I'm going to interrupt you real quick. This happens to be an area I know a little bit about, just so we know what we're talking about. Where this is not folks who have been determined to be insane, not guilty by reason of insanity or anything like that. These are folks who have been arrested for serious felony charges and are exhibiting some sort of mental illness, typically psychosis for the most part in this situation, to where they are so... their mental state is such that they cannot effectively appreciate the legal system. They can't work with their lawyers. They can't understand the process. And so there's a system whereby a lawyer files a motion for the court to have their ability to understand the process has to be restored. So there's a legal process for that. The judge makes a determination. They're then sent to the department. The department's job is to provide them services so that they can become competent to understand the system, and then they're sent back to their jurisdiction to go through the legal process and the trial and everything that goes with that. Fair enough.
Correct.
That makes sense to everybody? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for making that point. That's correct. So the average age of the individuals who go through that process is 40. So I just wanted to point that out to you as well. And when we looked at the charges, as you discussed, those felony charges, a lot of them are like assault on a Leo, some issues with just indecent exposure. So they have a whole host of different misdemeanors that led them to the point of a felony charge, like trespassing, but it's repeat behavior that occurs. So Chapter 394. So these are our civil commitments. You know, most people know this by the Baker Act. So we get patients' packets that are referred to us. So a receiving facility, so a CSU or a hospital system, has determined that that patient needs further care. They need ongoing care. So in that case, they go and petition the court for them to receive ongoing treatment. And in that instance, then, for those that are civilly admitted, they are then remitted to the department, to our care, into that setting. And for those individuals, as you see, here's the criteria. So it's been determined that there's no least restrictive alternative, that they're not able to provide, to take care of themselves alone. They're just incapable of being able to do that. And for us, with that population, it is our average patient population, like age, is 47 in that population. So treatment at our facilities. Our treatment is individualized. We use a clinical staff to provide a whole person approach. We have a multidisciplinary team, and it offers just a diversified approach to care from all aspects of need. So with this treatment team, it's comprised of psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, licensed mental health therapists, licensed clinical social workers, master's level therapists, a whole host of other healthcare professionals. We even have like behavioral health techs. And as a part of this, once the patient is able to engage, they are a part of this as well. So based upon the assessment that's conducted by the team, the patient then begins the appropriate medication. So psychotropic medication therapy, they get crisis management, behavioral health programming. And then of course, for those who need to understand the judicial system, they begin competency training. So the goal is to make sure that they understand their charges and they're ready to return to court. So overall, at our hospitals, we provide over 46 individual types of treatment, and this treatment is supported by, we have about 2,286 full-time staff who do this. Most of these individuals are definitely highly skilled and are educated candidates who do this. And it's just a difficult environment to work within, so you have to have a passion for it. So our folks that are there are highly passionate and very committed, specifically when you work with individuals who are in active psychosis. So our goal here is to make sure that we allow patients to be stabilized and so they can achieve just the highest level of mobility. By what I'm saying is that in this instance, when you first come into the hospital setting, a lot of things are directive, but as you begin to gain competency or you're more stabilized, you get greater freedom in terms of the choices you make around the therapeutic interventions that you would like to engage in. You have more freedom of movement, because our goal overall is to make sure that you can safely go back into the community and that you are able to have the skills necessary for you to be able to operate independently. So for our inpatient care, I just want to point out that for our patients who come in under 916, our forensic patients, it usually takes us about 100 days before they're able to be discharged back to their county of origin. And for our civil patients, it usually takes about 2.5 years is the average length of stay in that space. So I wanted to just demonstrate the total number of patients and the growth that we've seen in our state hospitals. So you see that spanning over the last couple of years. So what's most important and what we're most proud of is that we were able to increase this by 32% overall when you look at the green bar. I just want to talk a little bit about some of the results that we've seen over the past 17 months. So we were able to bring on over 800 beds, which is important. And we were able to do that with the support that we received from the governor and also from the legislature. Without that funding, we wouldn't be able to do that. So at Florida State Hospital alone, we were able to open like 651 beds. At Northeast Florida State Hospital, 138 beds. And then we opened 12 additional beds at two other hospitals, at the North Florida Evaluation Treatment Center and our South Florida State Hospital. So currently we have, through our staff aug, onboarded additional clinical professionals to support the work and to keep beds open and to expand our bed footprint, and that's around about 500. So we also have been able to increase our discharges by getting folks more quickly stabilized and back into their communities so that they're able to receive the ongoing care. So like I said, we're just super proud of that. And we've been able to achieve this in spite of the growth rate. So just wanted to talk a little bit about what we've done in terms of our results. And I'm going to turn it over to Tony Lloyd to go into the budget.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Eric. Good morning, Chairman. Good to you. Yes. Budget slide. Good morning. I am Tony Lloyd, Assistant Secretary for Administration. The two tables on this slide describe the funding streams that support our six mental health treatment facilities. These six facilities are budgeted at a total of $466 million, of which $361 million is general revenue. So the state's highly engaged in funding these. That's about 77% of the funding stream. The federal grants trust fund that you see up there is what we call DSH, or disproportionate share hospitals. In other words, hospitals that have a disproportionate share of Medicaid eligible patients are eligible for some federal funding. That's where that comes from. A small piece of a state trust fund. And then the last one that I would point out is essentially new funding with the opioid settlement money. We're able to use the graduate medical education program inside of our hospitals, which will allow us to fund folks doing residencies and internships and things of that nature. We talked a lot this morning about bed counts. This table gives you a lot of information about how many beds we have, where they're located, and the types of beds that they are. The first three facilities are state operated. The other three we contract with for managing and providing those services. And you'll see the difference between civil and forensic. And the step down beds, when I describe step down beds, those are essentially, as she described, a patient that would have come in as at forensic, and as they stabilize, we can move them to a less restrictive environment. It allows us to move them to a, quote, step-down bed, which is really, frankly, a civil bed. It's less restrictive, but they've stabilized to the point where they can be in that environment. So that frees up the forensic beds for someone else that's coming in, as you
said. I'm going to just be warm. The question on the step-down issue, are those folks that still don't meet the criteria yet, but just they're not as acute? Is that
correct? So those are patients who are on their way to being stabilized. They're still going to continue with their ongoing treatment, but again, they are able to engage more. So they have an understanding of their disease state. They understand their medications. They're very cooperative. We want to make sure that, again, we give them just freedom. So at this juncture, you're able to do more things like choose to help with your laundry or go engage in vocational activities, or you're able to choose the recreational activities. So we step them down from a program that's more structured programming.
So still not competent to proceed, but but making progress in treatment?
Making extreme progress.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Yes, sir. And the only reason for pointing that, it gives us a little bit of flexibility between forensic patients and civil patients. And I would point out when I get to a later slide, the age of the facilities. You can see, obviously, Florida State Hospital's been there for a long time. We did some research, and I think the last building that was constructed there was 1947. So it's been a while since we've had a new building there. These are large campuses. For McClenny, Northeast Florida, I think mid-60s was the last building built. They're big campuses, and they've been there for a while. The next slide, we talk about staffing of the mental health facilities and the ongoing challenge that has been. As a frame of reference, there's about, as you can see here, about 3,000 FTE that work for the department. Pre-pandemic, we would average 300 to 400 vacancies. And so, you know, being at 10 to 12%, that was a manageable amount of vacancies. And so we were able to keep beds staffed and operate at that point. In early 2020, those vacancies shot up to 700, and quite frankly, they have stayed there. Some of the impact of that was we had to shut down wings, shut down beds, part of what Erica referred to. Opening 800 beds, some of those were being reopened after they had to be closed because of staffing shortages for a few months. Fortunately, the legislature, and we appreciate it, provided significant funding, $77 million, to do staff augmentation and to be able to open beds. And you see that at the bottom slide. So the net effect of this is we have, and it's a snapshot in time, but essentially 547 contracted staff that are working inside of our facilities today. And if you subtract the 547 from the 700, then you see that we've effectively have about 150 vacancies, which is more like 5%. That has allowed us, that funding and that ability to bring in contract staff has allowed us to bring that vacancy rate down, which has allowed us to reopen all those beds, plus, again, with funding from the legislature and being able to move some things around inside of our agency, we've been able to open another 257 beds this summer, and we're online to bring on the last 139 that we have scheduled in January. So that's going to allow us, again, more throughput in terms of being able to have access for folks that need it. And the earlier slide that she showed you, we've gone up to like 5,700 patients coming through in a given year. So it's important to be able to have those beds available. But this is how we're doing the staffing now. The last slide I have is, is for capital improvements. And I know funds are limited and capital improvements, FCO is always difficult to get in a state budget. And I appreciate the decisions that you have to make in terms of that. I will not go through 5 years, but I'm going to point out just for our three state hospitals, some of the things that are in the 24-25 ask. To point out, these are, I don't know how many of you have had an opportunity to go visit any of our facilities or tour any of our facilities. But when we say hospital, you may think of a standalone hospital. These are campuses. Florida State Hospital has over 100 buildings. Northeast Florida has over 70 buildings, and NevTech has 35 buildings. So they're literally campuses with full infrastructure, electric, water, et cetera. So it's a lot to maintain. So in our ask, we're not asking.
Before you get there, can I ask a real question?
Yes.
So you've got the three state facilities that are staffed by state employees. There's six facilities in total.
Yes, sir.
The facilities that are operated by the state's vendor are the physical plant their responsibility, or are they our responsibility? How does that work?
No, sir. Very good question. It is a shared responsibility in the contract. They have funding that they can handle anything under $100,000. So if it's a small repair, replacing this or that, there's funds in their budget to be able to do that. If they have any infrastructure needs that are beyond $100,000. They submit those to us. We didn't include them on this slide, but they're included in our request. So any infrastructure improvements that they need, they submit to us, and we include them in our legislative budget request.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was only going to go through a couple of these just to give you an idea. These are not nice-to-have things. These are fundamental infrastructure to help maintain these older campuses. At Florida State Hospital, of that $17 million, $6 million is to replace fire alarms, $3.5 million to replace main electrical panels, $3 million to upgrade kitchen exhaust, ductwork, and coolers and freezers, $2 million to repave half a mile of Main Street, and $1 million to repair the gutter system on one of our main patient buildings. At NevTech, we're replacing 44 doors and frames, and we're replacing showers and commodes. So it's very nuts and bolts kind of thing. At Nefish, it's replacing $6.9 million to replace the HVAC on two of the buildings that house our patients, and $2 million for phase one of a boiler replacement, just to give you an idea of the kinds of things that we're asking for there. That concludes my presentation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you both. If you just hang tight, I'm sure we have some member questions, and we're going to get started with Representative Bolsey.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I have had the opportunity to visit Chattahoochee, and you can tell by the age that it does need a lot of work, and I know that it is a huge economic driver for that community as well, just it because of the size of it. There's a lot of expansion that can probably happen. My question is really goes back to page 14, and I'm looking at the staffing contracts that you have, and I'm wondering, we didn't really discuss this, I'm wondering, are you having a hard time retaining psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, because the ratio of these professionals to patients seems to be extremely high?
You recognize.
Thank you. That's a great question. Absolutely. You know, throughout the nation, there are workforce challenges, specifically in the behavioral health space. We are all competing for that workforce, specifically as we begin to explore and expand the footprint of telehealth, which is great. It's a great asset. However, on those telehealth platforms, you have those same individuals providing that level of care, and you have an opportunity to choose your patient load, the types of patients you want to see from the comfort of your own home. And also the pay is competitive. So across the nation, it is a problem, and definitely one that we experience specifically as we're asking for the highest level of acuity. If we look historically, when I went through the School of Social Work, what was deemed to be the ideal job for you is to go into a crisis stabilization unit, because that's where you got your credibility. That's how you got your skill set. That's what made you a professional. But now that is not the same. It is not the same for the environment, specifically because it's nights and weekends, long hours, and dealing with a patient population that, not by any fault of their own, they're unable to control their behaviors, their emotions, their outburst. So it is a challenging environment. So that is correct.
Thank yes, ma'am.
May I have one follow-up?
Of course.
Thank you. On another subject, you mentioned earlier in your presentation how many beds that you have available, how many you've opened up, but in reality, how many do you need?
You recognize.
Thank you. You know, that's an ongoing discussion for us. As soon as we get to our wait list to a good place, I think at one point we had a reduction by 52%.
Let me interrupt you quick. Describe your wait list. What does that mean?
So our wait lists are those that are waiting to receive care in our state hospitals. So that wait list can either come from either a sheriff department who's holding an individual in jail until there's a bed available, or they're receiving care at a CSU. A crisis stabilization unit that is a designated facility that provides care to individuals who have been Baker Acted. And once determined that they are not stable and they cannot be returned on their own to their own community or homes, they are retained as required by law. So in that instance, we do have a wait list. So for our civil wait list, right now we have 18 available beds, and we have 18 people who are moving into those beds. So we're in a good posture when it comes to the civil wait list. But in terms of our forensic wait list, those that come in through 916, we have just a tremendous need. And right now, it is really a challenge for us to figure out, because at one point we were receiving petitions for care like 75 a week, you know, so it continues to outpace the ability for us to be able to renovate buildings, get beds online, get staff trained, and to be able to move those individuals into beds. So I'm really proud of the efforts that we've made thus far, but to have a particular idea around that, we we would have to know what the total need around the level of acuity. So we're talking about people who are severely and persistently mentally ill, and we continue to ask ourselves that very same question. So I don't have a good answer for you because it's ever-changing.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, ma'am. I'm going to just tell you from my perspective, we just need more. I mean, and I'm not being smart aleck about it. I mean, if you talk to any sheriff in this state, especially in the major urban areas, they will tell you that the backlog issue is real. Talk to judges, talk to prosecutors. It's real. And these are the folks who, quite frankly, have already been through the judicial process and to be deemed necessary for these services. So they've been sitting in these jails for the most part, at least 90 days or more to begin with. These jails do not have, they're jail, all right? They don't have people on staff to help. They're decompensating. It's a major cost driver for sheriffs. It's a major risk for the detention professionals who have to, you know, keep them safe. And I've yet to talk to a sheriff who says this is not a problem, or a prosecutor, or state attorney, or folks in the defense bar as well. So that, for what it's worth, I'm going to answer that question and say, at least on the forensic side, especially post-COVID, it's been a massive surge. And like they were talking about, the workforce challenges cause available beds to go down. Post-COVID, yes. Crap we're dealing with in the world is causing stuff to go up. It's a mess. So anyway, sorry to answer your question instead of the professionals. Representative Kennedy.
Thank you, Chair. Just a follow-up. I'm on page 3. I'm looking at the locations. As someone who represents Polk County smack in between Central and Suncoast, I'm just looking at the geography and wondering whether, when you break down the wait list, are there regional challenges related to just the location and the reality that doesn't look like we have facilities in Central Florida?
You recognize.
Thank you. So how the process works is as we review the packets as a totality of system. And then where an available bed is that needs that level of care is where that individual goes. And that's where they receive their care. So specifically, we have some hospitals that are solely focused on like civil. So if you look at the hospital that's right outside of Jacksonville, that is civil beds. So at Florida State Hospital, they both have forensic beds and civil beds. And at NEFTEC, those are our forensic beds. And I get these confused. Well, it says right there in the title. So Treasure Coast is forensic. And then we have South Florida State Hospital that also has civil beds as well. So it depends on the type of bed that you need. And as I mentioned in the presentation, so 79% of our population right now and of our beds are for males. And that's where we see the need. And the remainder are for females. And then, of course, we do things, again, like making sure that we have patients who need specific needs, like if you additionally have a co-occurring medical need, you're like medically fragile, you can receive care at Florida State Hospital because we have the ability to provide care in those settings. So all of those things are taken under consideration. And sometimes the family has a preference in terms of wanting to be close to their loved one, and we try to accommodate if those beds are available.
All right, we're going to go to Rep. Skidmore, then Vice Chair Jacques, and then Representative Mello. Rep. Skidmore, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The chair referenced homelessness early in his opening remarks, and it seems like a large portion of the homeless population is experiencing some severe mental illness. I mean, you can just walk, you know, from the Capitol down the street, and there'll be several people mm-hmm. who are having an argument with themselves. When you have a patient and you stabilize that patient, they go back to court, if they are not jailed or imprisoned and they are just, you know, sort of let go of their own accord, what are the services available? I know it's the step after you, but I feel like you're a big part of whether they can continue to get care somewhere else and how we might be able to do that. I don't know if I articulated that very well.
You recognize.
Thank you, Nay. Articulated that perfectly, and thank you for the question. So we do plan and have discharge planning. So what we do once an individual steps down out of a state hospital is that there's a team that plans their discharge planning. We work in coordination with our managing entities. Those are our vendors who are responsible for a network of behavioral health providers. And so some of our goals in that instance is to figure out, like, what level of care are they ready for? We have a number of providers who do things across the board, like, you know, when that comes to mind is like Boley Center, that has an array of services from being able to have residential to something that supervises apartments to the next level where an individual's able to receive housing, but that housing is wrapped around with additional supports so that individual is able to maintain and have stability. But they also have that those therapeutic interventions where there's group, there are peers, there's individual counseling, there's medication management. There's also a system set up that if that person finds themselves in crisis, that they're able to use a mobile response team, like a crisis team, to come in and work with that individual. And to your point, we do recognize that once we get individuals stable and we give them independence and they're able to have a safe place to live, that they don't want to do anything to lose that ability to operate independently. And that's what we lean upon. So there are lots of programs that are designed to do that. But unfortunately, recovery is not linear. So many people find themselves not, like I said, no fault of their own. It is just difficult to be able to maintain specifically on just your medication regime, because it's like what we do, right? You feel better when you're taking antibiotics and they tell you to take a 10-day course and you're like, it's day five, I'm fine. I'm not gonna take that. And so that's the cycle that we find our patients in. And so we spend a lot of time working to make sure that they understand, but for this, this is where you find yourselves, where you no longer have your civil liberties. So we do have lots of programs that we work with and providers that help to be able to support that.
Thank you. We're going to go to Vice Chair Jacques.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. I kind of want to just dissect more into the bed capacity issue. I want to kind of get a better picture if the capacity number is the same as the availability numbers. So basically, as far as beds that are not being used, are all of them available to be used right now? So for example, Florida State Hospital, 1,492 beds, that's the capacity. Of those beds that aren't being used, can they be utilized right now? Or is it just, are some available or some not available?
Do you mind letting me know what slide?
Yes. It is slide 4.
Thank you, sorry.
Yes, no, no,
you didn't recognize my apologies.
No, yes, you're absolutely, you go back, please.
So in response to that, so for those beds currently, all of our beds are full. So we would say that we are like 98% capacity, meaning that we have a flux. People are being discharged from those beds and we're actively working to move individuals into the beds. So we don't currently have beds that are funded beds where they're staff beds that are not being utilized. We are working to bring beds online. So to your question, are you asking, do we have the ability to bring more beds online?
Correct.
I'm confused because you've got a 22%, I think you said, rate of FTE deficit, right? Spots that need to be filled in the state facility, in the three state-run facilities that aren't being filled. What effect does that have on the number of beds that are available? I think that's what the vice chair is getting at, and I think it's a good question.
Absolutely. Let me take a shot at that. So if you think in terms of the total staffing, we have 3,000 state employees and got 700 vacancies. We have backfilled those with roughly 550 contract staff, nurses, et cetera. So from a staffing standpoint, we're at a 5% of the 3,000 that we should have. So from that perspective, we're fully staffed because of the contract staff. What we have been able to do in the last year and a half is go from, some frame of reference, we had about 2,600 beds. The last bed that came online was when we added the last private hospital. So that was like 2011, 2010. That got us to 2,600 beds. We were at 2,600 beds from there until today. At one point during the pandemic, because of vacancies, we had to close some beds that we were currently using. So we went down, and then we reopened them. So long and short, we've been able to open about, by January, another 400 beds. So we'll be at 3,100 beds. So we can staff those. To your question, though, Florida State campus is a large campus. There are a lot of buildings. There are a lot of older buildings. Are there buildings that we have mothballed that would take lots of money, millions of dollars, to bring back online and then more money to staff them, that's an option.
So, I mean, I'm going to interrupt. I'm sorry for interrupting. Please. This is in it. So I'll use NEFISH. I see Representative Brandon out there who's a champion for NEFISH. I'll use that as an example. Are they at 100% capacity right now? Are we at max capacity at NEFISH?
We're at, yes, sir.
Okay. So there's no more space to put people.
There's no more space in buildings that are up and functioning.
Okay. Got it. Sorry, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as just a follow-up, just say over the last 20, 30 years or so, how has the capacity changed as far as, I mean, what are the trend lines? Has there been greater capacity? Are we at the same numbers as we were, you know, a couple decades ago? Where do we stand?
You look at facility age, sir. I stand corrected. The last new beds we brought online was in 2006. That was when we got to about 2,600 beds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Representative Mello, I think you're up, and then Representative Abbott.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. In 2022, I ran HB 1349. Which was intended to improve the wait list. So I became very familiar with the civil and forensic patient and how the judicial system, too early in the morning for me, works. So my question to you is, have you had an opportunity to see if that is actually improving the wait list?
You recognize.
Thank you, and thank you for your support with that, and we appreciate that tremendously. So as of the right now, we are actively working through the components of that. We've done a lot of training with the judicial system, with the public defender's office, and also with the evaluators to make sure that everybody has awareness about alternative placement. You know, but it does take time once you train and start speaking of that, specifically when everyone believes that the only option is a state hospital. So we are working through that to make sure that the available and appropriate placements are well known. We are developing resource guides to make sure that in the court, when someone's making a decision about a petition, they can do that. And the language there where it says to contemplate alternative settings has been very helpful because we see those are being contemplated. We also have increased our pre-diversion rate where individuals do not have to go to the state hospital. So that indeed has been something that has borne fruit for us. But again, just the total number of individuals that need this type of care has grown tremendously.
Chair, I have two more.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair.
For both.
Thank you. My next question is, you know, I heard you say average 2.5 years and referring to someone who, yes, is stabilized. We get them in the facility. We get them leveled out and on the correct medications. Is there any partnerships or alternatives that we could free up beds and get them in other facilities that aren't as secure and maybe don't where they don't necessarily need a crisis environment that would have the affordability to free up more beds for the people that are in that crisis mode?
You recognize.
Thank you. As soon as the individuals are stable enough to be able to safely receive care in another setting, they are moved to that setting. When I first walked through the door in this role, I think our average length of stay for civil was about 7 years. So we've done a lot of partnerships since 2021 to make sure we could broker that and have individuals move. Because the last thing we want is people to become institutionalized and feel like that's the only safe place to receive care or that's the only place where they can thrive. So we really have been working on those relationships. We have some great partners, like in Nassau County with Doug Atkins, with Dayspring. We've got Lifeway, Grace Point, a couple of others who actually have conditional release beds. We do have some other programs, like housing programs, like Ability in Jacksonville, who work with us to be able to move our patients through. So we do use those levers when appropriate for them to move those levers.
Thank you. And one final question. In terms of staffing, because, again, in the past I've run a nursing home bill, which we discuss staffing a lot. When you talk about agency contract staffing, do you know what your ratio is? Because I know that those agency contract employees or staff are much more expensive than an FTE. Do you know what your ratio is for contract staff versus FTE staff?
You recognize.
Thank you. So according to Tony, it's about 20%. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Abbott, Rep. Tobolsky, and Rep. Salzman, and then we're going to wrap it up. Rep. Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I, at following the Chair's lead, we have a huge need. And we have, I hear from your presentation, we have a lot of aging facilities. What is our plan moving forward? What is our build-out plan? Are we looking at adding new hospitals in the state, or are we looking at adding new facilities on our current campuses at all?
You recognize.
Thank you. Across the board, we've looked at a number of things, from being able to see if there are opportunities to open the buildings that have been closed, the one that Tony referenced as mothballed buildings, also looking to see if we can expand and build in new areas on those campuses, as well as looking at opportunities for the development of another hospital if needed. So across the board, we're looking at all options available to us.
I'll tell you for what it's worth, as someone, my opinion, which is worth what you pay for, which is not very much. Gainesville and Alachua County, University of Florida is an incredible asset in areas of mental health. They do great work down there. We have a facility there that opened in 1976, but it only has 216 forensic beds. That area can, they have the workforce to handle it, and the cost of construction is nowhere near what it is in major urban areas. And it's halfway between Jacksonville and Tampa. So, just my opinion for what it's worth, but that would seem to be an area that's worthwhile to invest in. But just my opinion. Representative Tribolsi and then, Tribolsi and then Salzman.
Thank you, Chair. You're saving the best for last. My question is around recidivism. And what are we doing when these patients go back home, back to their community, to wrap them around with services or keep track of them so that we can keep our recidivism rate low?
Recognize.
Thank you. That actually is a great question. It's something that we track. We track our recidivism in two ways. We have a 100-day recidivism rate, which is like less than 5%. You know, like it is very low. So it is, we're below the national average considerably. And then there's 180-day, and that is about 2% overall. So for us, and the national average is around, I want to say, about 10%. Don't quote me. I will get you the right percentages so you can see our recidivism rate. But I know that we're doing very well with that, far better than we expected. So we are impressed with that. But that also is because we're leaning upon our community providers to wrap that individual around with care once they go into their area of origin. So that we know has been working well once we get an individual stabilized.
Thank you. Rep. Salzman, then we'll move on to our next presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation today. And before I ask this question, I just want to thank you for participating and being a big part of the Mental Health Task Force and the Panhandle. Most people know what the work that we've done. A lot of the agencies have even implemented some of the findings that from the strategic plan that we created in Pensacola. And I know that I have a strong partner in you guys in looking at how we can really facilitate access to mental health care in a meaningful way. And this presentation is great. It talks about the end result, but I just want to make sure that it's on our minds and maybe have you speak to what are our plans to prevent having to get to this point? You know, we're looking at long-term treatment facilities. We're actually going to open up 14 long-term care beds in Pensacola and then 10 for adolescent in Panama City as a pilot until we get this off the ground in the Panhandle. But, you know, discussing with your agency and ACA and all of the major stakeholders, we recognize that we're putting Band-Aids on people by using the Baker Act as a way to treat, and then we do that enough to where they're in jails, they're on probation, then they're in prison, and, you know, all of these things are mentally scarring in themselves and just putting scars upon scars and trauma upon trauma, and then, of course, they're going to end up in this facility, and our numbers are going to continue to increase because we're not treating the patient in a meaningful way. So we're working on that in the Panhandle. What is the plan? What are the conversations in your agency in reference to long-term treatment care well before we get to this point? I can't imagine the dollars that we're going to save, and I know we're working on creating some numbers so we can really quantify how much savings for a state, but for humanity itself, it just makes more sense to invest more before they get here than more into when they get here.
Recognize.
Thank you. That definitely is something that's at the forefront of mind for all of us, something we're very concerned with. Because of the investments that we were provided with the $126 million that we got legislatively and signed off by the governor, we were able to do a number of things to be able to bolster the services that are available in the community. The first thing that we focused on is beginning to make sure that people had awareness about services. And we know if you don't understand the system and you don't know where services are, you can't go and receive services at the right time. We really have been trying to focus on things like getting people to a place of understanding and mental health well-being before you find yourself in a place of crisis. Some of our funding that's established federally has us focus on crisis, unfortunately. But what we did do is we did take a step back to see what types of services that we need to have upstream of that. And those services are in the place of our teaming models, our multidisciplinary teaming models that we utilize, such as the FAC team that we have, which is our Florida Community Assertive Action team that we have, and our teams like using the mobile response teams, but also making investments in things that we know, like residential levels of care, where residential less restrictive, but it also is there and available should you need that care at that point. But even upstream of that, making sure that we have outpatient treatment services available, recognizing that folks know when they go to where's your behavioral health hub. If you don't know where to turn, where should you go? That is looking at what we refer to as CRFs, our central receiving systems. So in that system, if you have something that is going on that is an urgent need, it is helping folks know how to navigate that. There could be much more training on that statewide in terms of just the consumers to understand, much like the push that happened with the emergency departments where we were all redirected to use urgent care. We were given, you know, patient navigators to help us know when we should go see our PCP as a prize to going to the emergency department for the highest level of care. So all of those things are at stake for us. We've been working through the Mental Health Commission to look at the system of care in totality with the number of individuals that are assigned to that, as well as working with other associations to understand how can we message this so people can move upstream. So what do we do when you have that moment of somebody who is anxious or has clinical depression? So we don't want to wait, to your point, to where it's a complete crisis episode, but not waiting until it's, you know, Friday night at 11 o'clock and there's nowhere else to go, but recognizing what we need to do in terms of that by establishing a behavioral health home. So these are all the efforts that we're doing as we look at what specifically is needed. And with the partnership we have with the managing entities, as they're going over and reviewing, doing their needs assessment, and looking at each county, each region, their catchment area, and determining what those needs are. We do this by trying to pilot new things to see if a pilot that has a promising practice is something that can be elevated to an evidence-based practice that could have a further reach that can meet the needs of those who have those care concerns. So we really are trying to take a global look at it. You know, I wish that we had a magic wand and a panacea to get it right, but we are actively working to move from the point of having so many people find themselves at the very highest level of care.
Representative Salzman, we have to keep it quick, if you don't mind.
So I appreciate all the efforts that are happening, and y'all have been a phenomenal partner. One of the pilots was the CRF years ago, the mobile response teams. Those are all examples of pilot programs that you guys have created and launched, and now we're moving them across the state. In the CRF conversation, I mean, we put that in the budget 6 months ago, and the managing entities have not been paid for it, so it's 6 months into services. So that's just a comment. But the final question I have is, are you guys looking at potentially partnering with ACA for the 1189 waiver program that we have? We have it in two regions in Florida. We're not using all of the resources that are allocated each year, and that waiver would provide these long-term housing options for these people as they transition out of your facilities.
You recognize.
Thank you. So we are always working to partner with ACA to make sure that we are on the same page, specifically as we talked about, looking at our crisis beds, you know, looking at services across the board, talking about just behavioral health professionals and what needs to happen in that space. So we do have ongoing partnership. Specifically talking about expanding that 1115 waiver for the housing pilot, yes. So we definitely have been looking and working on housing collectively, but that's something that we can work in a more concerted effort to make sure that we have a promising practices moving forward to ensure that people have a place to go.
All right, thank you everyone for your discussion on this topic. We could talk about this for a long time, but I think the message hopefully that the department hears and everyone hears is that we understand this is an issue and this is a priority for many of the people in this committee and in this house. You're going to get sick of hearing me say that money follows vision, but it does. And so when we're talking about the substantial amount of money that would be necessary to increase the bed, if we're at max capacity right now for our existing plant, Representative, just one second, please. If we're at max capacity of our facilities now, to increase that capacity is going to cost a substantial amount of money. And I know I speak for, you know, Speaker Renner, and I know Speaker Desmond Perez and myself and all this. We're going to want to have a vision and a plan for any increased expenditures for how that's going to set us up for success for the challenges of the next 10, 20, 30 years. And there are going to be substantial challenges in this area in the next 10, 20, 30 years. Our last facility that came online was South Florida Evaluation Treatment Center. That was in 2006. Florida's changed a lot in the last 17, 18 years. And I suspect it will do even more so in the next 20 years ahead. So my ask to the department, and certainly we as the appropriators need to be intimately involved with that, is that we get a game plan together. We've been, post-COVID especially, we've been trying to hold this thing together with duct tape and chicken wire to make sure that we can provide what we need to provide. Tyranny of the urgent, you know, it's crisis mode. But now that things are starting to get stabilized, we need a long-term plan for where we're going to provide these needs for Floridians. And so I know we all know that, but it's important sometimes to hear it, and we want to partner with you all on that. And lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't recognize my friend Representative Brandon, who is here sitting in on this committee because he cares a lot about this issue. So I just want to thank him for his steadfast commitment and advocacy on behalf of the people of Baker County. All right. Thank you all very much. I appreciate you. And thank you for this. All right. Our next presentation is going to be by Jess Tharp, the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Community Services, to give an update on homelessness funding. Members, if you need to stretch your legs or grab some coffee, feel free to do so. Ms. Tharp, you are recognized. And members, we've got a 9:30 out. We're going to try our best to get this done without having to extend, but we may have to extend a few minutes. Just be aware of that, okay?
Sorry, I'm not trying to record.
All right, no problem. Take your time.
Well, as we're getting that pulled up, thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Garrison, Vice Chair Jacques, Ranking Member Woodson, and committee members for having us here today to provide information regarding homelessness continuums of care, the department's grant process to disseminate funding for homelessness initiatives, and updates on some of the new funding that became available this year. My name is Jess Tharp, and I have the honor of serving as the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Community Services. This is a new office within the department that was created under the leadership of Secretary Harris. I want to quickly provide some background for you on this new office because it is relevant to the rest of our presentation today on homelessness, where we've been historically, our current state, and where we want to go. Earlier this year, it became clear to our leadership team that some of our really special programs and populations, like individuals experiencing homelessness, survivors of domestic violence, youth who have aged out of care, vulnerable adults, and victims and survivors of human trafficking, that these populations and programs needed dedicated leadership, time, and resources to ensure that they have a robust continuum of care in each of these areas. The department is committed to ensuring that there is that dedicated focus on these programs and populations, and that we not only have appropriate, timely, and adequate responses to these issues, but that we are able to go further upstream and prevent or stop some of the generational cycles of domestic violence, youth entering care, and homelessness. So the department split off four programs from the Office of Child and Family Well-being, Adult Protection, Human Trafficking, Domestic Violence, and Continuing Care. And then we also split off homelessness from the Office of Economic Self-Sufficiency, our public benefits office. So you can see a theme here, really, really special programs and populations that were tucked up underneath very, very large programs. And so the point here in splitting these off is, again, making sure that there is a dedicated assistant secretary, a dedicated leadership team, dedicated time and resources to making sure that we're doing all that we can with these programs. With this shift, our homelessness, there we can get my face off of that screen. With this shift, our homelessness team, which consists of two program FTEs and eight contract management FTEs, for a total of 10 FTEs, that unit is now has that dedicated leadership focus from myself and a direct connection and escalation avenue to our executive leadership team. Where before they were competing, right, for time and resources and big issues with economic self-sufficiency and child welfare, they have myself as that dedicated leadership individual to help problem solve and identify resolution for our partners and providers. And we've already, since the shift that occurred August 1st of this year, we've already been able to work through some issues around administration costs and some of the flexibilities with challenge grant funding. I do want to shift our focus to our partner network and provide some information on the Homelessness Continuums of Care, or COCs. The department works with 27 COCs across the state. To become a COC, an entity must receive federal designation from Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, and the COCs really hold the responsibility of developing a coordinated plan to address and end homelessness within their community and their geographic service area. COCs receive funding from the department through appropriation by the legislature, as well as federal funding that is passed through the department to the COCs. Some COCs also receive funding and grants directly from HUD without passing through the department. Additionally, COCs and their providers that are working within their local community, they're working with their city and county governments to maximize both local government funding and private funding that may be available. Across the COCs and their providers last year, 128,000 individuals were served through various programs like street outreach, emergency shelter, homelessness prevention, rapid rehousing, permanent supportive housing, and housing case management. Every year, each COC conducts a point in time count, also referred to as the PIT count. And this is a coordinated effort over the course of about 24 hours where teams made up of housing specialists, case managers, street outreach workers, and volunteers, they canvass the community to try to identify and count every single individual that is experiencing this situation. These teams visit local community hotspots, homelessness camps, libraries, schools, other locations, shelters, and other areas not meant for human habitation to conduct that count. This count, again, is meant to represent the number of people experiencing homelessness at any given point in time. And last year in Florida, the COCs identified 30,809 individuals in this situation. I'll shift to funding streams for homelessness and COCs. Here you can see both the federal and the state funding streams that flow through the department and are disseminated to the COCs. Federal funding that is passed through the department includes Emergency Solutions Grant, or ESG, Base Emergency Shelter Grants, RUSH funding, and CARES funding from the pandemic. RUSH funding was a requested topic for this presentation today, so I'll expand upon that just a little bit more. RUSH funds became available to the COCs that covered counties that were included in the FEMA designation for individual assistance following Hurricane Ian. Those funds became available to the COCs earlier this year in July, and approximately $183,000 of the $3 million that is available has been spent to date by the COCs. They have until January of 2025 to expend these funds. Total federal funding that comes through the department is approximately $14 million. As I mentioned before, COCs, local housing authorities, city and county governments can also receive separate HUD grants directly and allocations directly from the federal government. Because of these various funding streams, it is critically important that COCs build, maintain, and sustain working relationships with their local governments and stakeholders to ensure that all parties are brought in to that coordinated homelessness plan and that they are maximizing all the dollars available in their community to support those that are experiencing homelessness and to prevent it. You can see the state funding streams, which total about $25 million, listed here, and I'll dive a little bit deeper into that in the next slide. All right, so on the state side, the COCs receive funding in two main categories, through staffing grants and challenge grants. Starting with staffing, this funding is disseminated evenly among the COCs to help build internal capacity for those COCs to do the great work that they do with their providers. The second investment that the state makes in COCs is through the challenge grant. This funding source is meant to be flexible and to spur innovation and best practices. Historically, the annual allocation for challenge has ranged from $3 to $5 million, with the past few years at $3.1 million. Last year, the legislature significantly increased that investment and allocated an additional $16+ million for challenge grants. This is a great first step in addressing some of the gaps that we have and addressing some of the cyclical issues that we talked about during the last presentation. On behalf of the department, the COCs, their providers, and the individuals being served through this funding, we thank the legislature for this monumental increase. The breakdown of challenge grants for state fiscal year 23-24 is listed here, and I'll walk you through each of these. They're down at the very bottom. The first one is regular challenge base, which is that $3.1 million. The base grant is allocated based on a ranking process that considers each COC's quality of services, homelessness need, and their ability to leverage federal and private funds. COCs received this funding earlier this year and have spent approximately almost $900K of that $3.1 million. The next grant level is Challenge Plus, made possible by that monumental investment last session. In our initial budget request for this increase for Challenge, the department identified initiatives and populations that would be supported. So we use a request for application process, or an RFA, in consultation with the Council on Homelessness to solicit applications from the COCs for the Challenge Plus funding. And what you see right there is 11.3. A majority of the COCs responded to that RFA and requested funding. However, not all COCs requested Challenge Plus funding. Through that RFA process, COCs could request funding for the following two categories: housing initiatives for families that are involved in the child welfare system and who have a goal of a reunification. Oftentimes, the barriers to reunification is housing, so we wanted to maximize this opportunity and this funding to support that and bring families back together. The second category is for, again, individuals that are involved in the child welfare system but may not be in that reunification process, but just maybe generally involved, and or are involved in the managing entity system of care due to a serious mental illness or substance use disorder. So these populations for the second initiative can include domestic violence survivors who may be involved in a child protective investigation, youth who are aging out of care, and other populations that have serious mental illness and that need some more of that permanent supportive housing. Allocations considered data regarding the categories I just mentioned, the amount requested by the COC, and the $750,000 cap that's in statute. Based on the COCs that applied and the requested amounts, we are able to allocate $11.3 million of the $16 million that was available. Lastly, you see Base Plus listed, and after disseminating both the regular base and the Challenge Plus, that $11.3 million, we had approximately $5.4 million left over, and we utilized the regular base methodology to allocate that to all the COCs. All challenge funding has been allocated to the COCs, and we are in the final stages of contract execution for Challenge Plus and Base Plus, and we expect the COCs to have those this week, as early as this week. We also included a breakout of each COC and by funding stream source. So you can see that breakdown here. The first four funding columns you see are our state funding streams, base challenge, challenge grant increase, which includes the challenge plus and the base plus, base housing assistance, and housing assistance increase, which are your staffing grants for the COCs. The next three columns, and I'll go to the next slide because we had to put it on two slides. The next three columns are the federal funding streams that I mentioned earlier that flow through the department to the COCs. And of course, you have your total on the far right column. In closing, Chair, I just wanted you to know that homelessness is an important issue to me as well, not just because it falls within my program area. Before I came to the department, I worked for a local provider here in Tallahassee who focused on serving kids in the child welfare system, but also focused on serving homeless, runaway, and at-risk youth. So this issue is very near and dear to my heart, and we look forward to continuing with the dedicated focus and leadership that we have now in the new Office of Community Services to building strong homelessness prevention programs and moving further upstream. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much. I know the ranking member Woodson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make it quick, and I'm going to try to put two questions into one for the sake of time. Thank you for your presentation again. And we know that homelessness is an issue that continues to plague our state when it comes to people finding a place to stay. And the more money we invest for homelessness, the more we're seeing more people are homeless in our streets. So one category that I'm very passionate about is the children who are aging out of the foster care system. So are we looking at increasing the allocations that they get once they get out of the foster care system, or where are we with those kids when it comes to homelessness? And the other questions, I'm going to put, Mr. Chair, if I may put questions out.
Yes,
have we done an analysis, comparison analysis toward the state to see where we are experiencing the highest level of homelessness in order for us to redirect those fundings to those areas? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome, and you are recognized.
Thank you. Great question, Representative. I'll try to get to, both of those in one response. First and foremost, children aging out of foster care. I served as the Assistant Secretary of the Child and Family Wellbeing System before coming into this role. So again, we have several initiatives there for those youth that are aging out. I think we can always do better, but there are several programs that are available for them, and I know we've had some conversations. We're happy to follow up with you on that. Extended foster care, PES, aftercare, and then we also established the Office of Continuing Care for youth who have aged out and get disconnected from their case manager or their independent living specialist. They always have that connection point, and we're utilizing Hope Florida and that model to help and assist those youth. You asked about an increase in allocation for youth that are aging out of foster care. Are you talking about their individual stipends that they are receiving if they're in EFC or post-secondary support?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
We would always consider that. We're actually looking at an independent living expansion that would move the age up. It's not necessarily an increase, but it would open the populations that would be eligible for some of those programs. So we'd love to continue that dialogue with you.
Representative Mello.
Second question.
Then Trabolsi. Come back. Representative Mello, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. My question to you, when I look at, obviously, numbers increasing, how can we get people off of the streets and chairing workforce, do we have, in terms of services for this group of people, can we have services for them where it's mandatory for them to, where we empower them to go into CareerSource and some of these other agencies to figure out how to get them upskilled and actually get them independent and keep them off the streets once they get stabilized? And that would be my question.
Recognize.
Thank you. And I do want to come back to Representative Woodson's second question, so we'll do that.
you can do them both. It's all good.
So as far as having mandatory services, that's really a legal question that I wouldn't be prepared to answer today. But with a lot of permanent supportive housing programs, there are wraparound services that are included in that. And they do have requirements for some of those programs as well, right? So you have to be meeting with your case manager weekly, right? Looking for jobs, right? It depends on the program, but there are programs like that that exist already.
Okay. We'll go to Representative Mill.
It's okay. Thank you.
Representative Tobolsky.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. This is a really important issue to me. While you were speaking, I live in St. Lucie County, and I was looking up the Treasure Coast Homeless Services Council, which represents St. Lucie, Martin, and Indian River County. And I'm on the website, and it says in January of 2023, there were a total of 925 individuals, 736 adult, and 189 children who were counted as homeless. How do you get that number? Because just in St. Lucie County alone, I also reached out to our school superintendent because I know that number is higher. And we've counted 2,000 children, students in St. Lucie County that are homeless. So there's a huge disparity there.
Sure. So there's several different methods, right? All COCs are required to use the Homelessness Management Information System, or HMIS. And so they are entering individuals into that system with unique identifiers, hopefully, right? And then there's also the PIT count. You also have, that I mentioned earlier during the presentation, you also have homelessness liaisons that work in the school systems that are working directly with those youth who they are identifying as homeless. And so I don't know, I didn't hear where your 2,000 number came from, but we can definitely, I think, follow up and try to reconcile some of that data.
Thank you. It was St. Lucie County, and I'd really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to kind of bring this in for a landing because we have one more presentation. I want to respect everyone's time. But the question I have on this is, we put a substantial amount of taxpayer dollars, real money, supplement this program. And my question is, do we have plans in place to measure the effectiveness of those funds? Specifically, total homeless nights, number of unique clients, all this sort of stuff. You are what you measure. And I personally think it's a worthwhile investment if we know we're getting good ROI on the investment. So that's my question to you. Do we have, in addition to getting the money allocated and getting it out the door, do we have some accountability measures and matrix to understand whether it's a worthwhile investment to continue to make?
Yes, thank you for that question, Chair. So the legislature also provided the department with approximately $900,000 to undertake a modernization effort or project regarding data. And so we're in the process of that right now, working with the COCs on trying to get that. What we get currently is kind of roll-up aggregate data. It's not really data that we can drill down and really kind of piece apart some of these outcomes and more meaningful things that we want to look at. So we're in the process of going through that project right now, working with the COCs on that, and we look forward to when we complete that, being able to present and follow up with you on some of those.
We have a substantial number of COCs. Like any organization, I'm sure there are some. I know Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust has always been the gold standard in this area. I would love to know, as we move through this process and continue to make these investments, I'm not a big believer in just everybody gets money. I want to make these investments in areas that are showing results. I know members of the committee do too. So my encouragement is that we develop a process by which we try to measure these sorts of things and make sure that we're getting the best bang for our buck in this area. So with that, any other questions? If not, we're going to turn it over to Secretary Branham and the Department of Elder Affairs, and we're going to give you a little extra time, Secretary, so you're good to go. All right, well, thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you for the work you do. All right, next up is Secretary Branham with the Department of Elder Affairs, small but mighty.
That is
true. It's good to see she's recovered from Monday night's football game. We're all still kind of working through it, but
no, Mr. Chair, I haven't recovered.
I haven't either, but it's good to see you, and you are recognized.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. First, I just want to thank my sister agency and thank them for all their hard work. It was a wonderful presentation. I really appreciated and learned a great deal myself, so thank you for that. Many thanks to Chair Garrison for having us, for Vice Chair Jacques, for Ranking Member Woodson, and for all of you today. If you know me and if I've gotten the chance to visit you, you know how important it is for me to be the Secretary of Elder Affairs and how honored and privileged I am to be serving our seniors. In my second year, I just celebrated my second year of service, and it still lights my heart on fire each and every day. I just got off a long trip, so I've been visiting with a lot of your regions and look forward to seeing more of you in the weeks and months to come. Right now, we're going to take a look at our Florida's Aging Network and the funding source, and I think this has been helpful. It was a good due diligence for our team and for me, so I just wanted to share this with you all as well. So just a quick snapshot of who we are. We are the State Unit on Aging. So the Department of Elder Affairs is the State Unit on Aging for the state of Florida. Every state in the nation has a State Unit on Aging. We are privileged because we have second highest prevalence of seniors per capita in the country to have our own Department of Elder Affairs. Some are tucked under Health and Human Services, but ours is a standalone agency. Under that, we have 11 area agencies on aging peppered throughout the state that serve underneath us, and we contract with them directly. We also have 48 lead agencies, and those lead agencies represent communities throughout the state of Florida that are contracted with the area agencies on aging. We have 307 congregate meal sites. Many of them are in your areas. They're fantastic. They'll serve 1 to 2 hot meals a day for free to as many seniors as they can, and it's a wonderful opportunity to give them a hot meal and some sociability. We also blanket over all of those are our memory disorder clinics, and those are through legislation. So over the years, we've maintained 17 memory disorder clinics throughout the state. I just got back visiting the one at Advent Health in Senator Broder's area and got the opportunity with Representative Plasencia, and it's a fantastic opportunity, usually part of a health system. And then we have 1.2 million seniors that we serve through all these programs, 1.2 of the 6.2 million total seniors. And then you see, again, the Dementia Care and Cure Initiative task forces. There's 16 of those, again, peppered throughout the state and usually work in conjunction with our memory disorder clinics and our area agencies on aging. So for the general revenue funding, we get our funding streams from two sources. One is from the Older Americans Act, which was incepted in 1965, and the other is through the state general revenue. So you see a couple of different buckets there. One is the Alzheimer's Disease Initiative, and that ADI provides services to meet the changing needs of individuals living with Alzheimer's disease and their families and caregivers. Right now in the state of Florida, we have 580,000 people living with Alzheimer's disease. We have second highest prevalence in the country. So this is a really important initiative for us, not just for the folks living with the disease, but also for the people providing them unpaid care. And that amounts to about 1 million people in the state of Florida providing unpaid care. So respite care is also available under ADI. Then we have our Community Care for the Elderly, and that's a very good program. It's a community-based services organized in a continuum of care, and that really is to help. In great part, the department is here to try to provide wraparound services to our seniors, and I like to say we're either seniors or we're seniors in the making. So all of this is really our future today and present, and then our future for tomorrow. So that continuum of care is wraparound services. They're here really to provide extra service support and programs that help us keep at home, living at home in the place of our choosing for as long as we possibly can. So it's the least restrictive, most cost-effective environment for a senior. Then we have our Home Care for the Elderly. You'll see the number up there. And Home Care for the Elderly supports care for Floridians age 60 and older in a family-type arrangement in private homes. And that's an alternative to institutional or nursing home care. And we're doing everything we can, again, to divert from nursing home care or long-term care communities, keep our seniors living at home where they thrive. Lastly, we have our respite for elders living in everyday families, and we like to call that our relief program. And those with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, that allows family caregivers to continue caring for homebound elders, thus avoiding the need to seek institutional services. And typically, relief will add respite care service, usually in the times that that traditional respite care isn't available, nights, weekends, times where the caregiver may need some time off to go shopping, maybe go to an event, maybe do something on the weekend for themselves. So I really love the relief program, and I think it's a very viable and important part of the services we provide. So next, we'll go to our federal grants. The department received the majority of its federal funding, like I said, from the Older Americans Act, incepted in 1965. Now, every state in the nation gets money from OAA. So what does OAA provide? It supports services like your adult daycares, and in many of your areas, I've visited your beautiful adult days. They serve community so well. Usually it's home-delivered meals. You'll know them as Meals on Wheels, typically. Homemaker services where people will come to the home and help with activities of daily living or perhaps chores. Elder Americans Act also provides education and training and information regarding elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation. And I've had a lot of conversations with some of you about the scams and exploitation, not just in long-term care communities, but what's happening to our seniors post-disaster and otherwise. We also offer one of my favorite programs, because it's volunteer-based and it's mostly seniors, is our SHINE program. And if you've ever had to deal with insurance, Medicare and Medicaid can be a hard and difficult thing to navigate. So SHINE really helps seniors navigate what they're eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. So it's an insurance opportunity for a volunteer to sit down with a senior. And then MIPPA. MIPPA is Medicare Improvement for Patients and Providers Act, which educates and assists low-income seniors and individuals with unique abilities to apply for programs that typically Medicare wouldn't cover. So it's an important program as well. And then last, you'll see up there is our Emergency Home Energy Assistance Program, or what we call EHEAP. We have to get to an acronyms here because they're long-winded programs, but which assist low-income households that are experiencing a home or energy emergency and usually will pay their utilities for a series of months until that family can get back on their feet again. So that's usually what EHEAP does. So I told you a little bit about the funding sources, but I wanted to tell you a little bit about the roles, because the Aging Network, when I got to become secretary, was confusing. So I wanted to break it down for all of us a little bit, because if it's confusing for me coming in as secretary, is it confusing for our elders? And it can be, because there are some layers to it. So I told you we have the State Unit on Aging, which is us. We take in the Older Americans Act money and the general revenue money, which I'm grateful to the legislature, who is always supportive of us and our programs. And then it goes down into the regional areas of Florida, which are the AAAs, the Area Agencies on Aging. They represent regions in Florida and usually will have a couple of counties underneath them. Underneath those AAAs are your 48 lead agencies, and you'll typically see them in our area, Representative Garrison. You'll see Nassau County Council on Aging, Clay County, and the like. So usually it's a county serving as a lead agency or a nonprofit.
Secretary, before you do that, we have one quick administrative matter to handle. Vice Chair Jacques.
Mr. Chair, I move that we extend the meeting for 10 minutes.
Without objection, the motion is granted. You are free to continue. Thank you, Secretary.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. So here's what our CFO calls our swim lane here. You'll see the federal grants and the general revenue programs feed into the Florida Department of Elder Affairs. We take down that money. We pass it to the area agencies on aging. We are bound to do that. The State Unit on Aging cannot provide direct service per the OAA. So the area agencies on aging cannot contract directly with service providers either, except for a few caveats. So usually that's outreach, referral, or if they submit a waiver saying that they need to provide direct service for a particular reason. So then you'll go into the lead agencies. Those lead agencies broker with our direct service providers in community. And then, of course, the seniors, which are the most important part of this swim lane.
Okay. So what does the DOEA do? The department is really responsible for the monitoring, training, technical assistance, education, and management of the contracts that we have with the AAAs. The department receives funding predominantly from the federal government, as I said, so we're managing about 200 contracts. Most of them are with our area agencies on aging, covering a myriad of programs and services that I described to you. So I shared the caveat for that, but typically the department, and we've been doing a great job in the past 2 years of enhancing our monitoring services. So we came out of COVID, no more desktop monitoring, no more Zoom monitoring. We're there in person with our monitoring and quality assurance. My expectations for the AAAs are extremely high. So I partner with them and talk to them often and much along with my team. So in those expectations of being high and expecting the very best, we went through a board reformation and then we asked all of the area agencies on aging to reform their board of directors and the way that they govern to make sure that it's consistent throughout the state. So that's one of the things that we got to do as an entire aging network. I looked, couldn't find one other state in the country that agreed to do that. All area agencies on aging agreeing to do that together. So that's one of our pieces of reformation in order to process, improve what we do. I think that's important because if our expectations as an agency are high, and mine personally as the secretary are extremely high for our aging network, then we also have to invest and set them up for success. So what we've been doing is working on a workshop series with them, meeting with them often and much like I said, a lot of them have new leadership, so do we. So making sure that we're all in concert and on the same page because the monitoring has become very rigorous and robust. Very appreciative to the area agencies on aging for being good partners and stewards in that process. And that really concludes, really, Chair, I just wanted to give you our roles, our responsibilities, how we receive our funding, and then what the stream of funding looks like to the end receiver, which is our cherished seniors. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions at this time.
Thank you, Sarah. Secretary, I know we have a couple. Representative Mello, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Secretary, for your presentation. On page 6 of your presentation, the swim lane graphic. These area agencies and lead agencies, are they similar to PBMs? Do they charge admin fees?
They do.
And do you have any idea what is actually captured in dollars per agency for these admin fees?
Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. So the department takes 3% in admin. The area agencies on aging take typically 10%. In admin, and then the lead agencies take between 8% and 10% in admin.
So I'm going to interrupt here for a second because that's interesting. So if I understand that correctly, does that mean I'm going to say $100 for purpose of our discussion. So you've got $100 that's allocated. That $100 becomes $97. Say 3% for you guys. So it becomes $97. You got 10%. At the area agency, so now you're down to $87, and you've got another, 7 to 8%? So now you're down to $79 of that $100 that's eaten up before it even gets to a senior. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I want to understand that. We'll come. Representative Mello.
Direct. One final question, and thank you,
Chair. Then Representative Steele.
My question would be, Secretary, do we have a need for 11 area agencies? When I think about how can we pass through more dollars to what I see as our most critical population that is growing in this Sunshine State. Do we need 11?
Mr. Chair?
You recognize.
Thank you for the question. And I think it's a really important question. So I'm glad you asked it because really thinking about what we can do as we have almost 1,000 people moving here daily, 25% of those are seniors. So 6.2 million people eventually in just a few short years will be 30% of our population will be seniors. So I think the question is important. Long before Michelle Branham, they put together a map of the 11 area agencies on aging, and that was really mirrored off of another sister agency, the idea being because Florida has so many seniors and in such a big state that they wanted to make sure that they had a lot of community representation, but that hasn't been visited for a long time. So we're not required statutorily or otherwise to have 11 area agencies on aging. The spirit of it was to make sure that all communities are represented so that those regional areas could broker with lead agencies and then down drilling down deep into community where we could get a voice for all communities. That was the spirit of it. But I understand the question. We're not bound or obligated by any statutory requirements to have 11.
Thank you, Representative Mill. Representative Steele, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. And I just had a real quick question, and you might not have the answer. Of the $312 million, how much is actually going to seniors?
By that, you mean in terms of
dollar
actual services rendered as opposed to admin stuff? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Representative Steele. It's something that keeps me up at night, and I think about a lot. I spent my first year of service out in the field. Some of the things you see, that is not our hope for our seniors today, nor is it my hope for the future. So I think about these things all the time. Because of the allocation, which is an OAA, is interstate funding allocation, each area agency on aging gets a different amount of money. So it's different depending on where you are. South Florida obviously has a very densely populated area of seniors, so their allocations are larger. And then you go into a more rural setting, like let's say Pensacola, where the allocations are smaller based on the population. So it's different depending on, and I can sit down with you and tell you a little bit about that depending on the area we're talking about what directly goes to seniors. I'm hoping that it does not answer your question.
Well, you follow up with a differently worded question, and we'll get an answer. Representative Steele, you want to follow up on that?
I don't know how else to ask it. Thank you, Chair. So if you have the $100 mark, mm-hmm. and 79% is supposed to be allocated to go to the senior, you know, I know there's other overhead that's not included in those other percentages. So I'm just trying to figure out actually how much is going to, and it's not by geographical region, I'm just saying in general terms, like you have $100, how much is actually going to the seniors?
Mr. Chair,
you're right.
Thank you. Now I understand. I'm sorry. After the admin money is taken, there are no additional overhead taken. So the rest of the money, the rest of that $100 would be going directly to service providers providing services to the seniors.
So under that, under that $100,
mm-hmm.
21% comes out for admin fees for state, area agencies on aging, and the lead agencies. Presumably the remaining 79% of that,
yes, sir.
$79 out of that $100 is going directly to folks that provide services.
That's correct.
Okay.
And in some cases where our aging network right now is dealing directly as a service provider, which they can do if it's not OAA money or general revenue money, this is ACL money, they can provide direct too, so they'll take the 10% and the remaining 90% is going direct to senior.
We've got about three more minutes. Representative Mello is staring at me eagerly with a question. Since I care for her deeply, I will recognize her for one more question.
Thank you, Chair. Same line of thinking. Is there any recommendations you would have for how we could get more dollars into the hands of the care of our seniors?
That's the money question.
Mr. Recognized. Chair.
I'd like to go out on that, so take your time and answer it.
I love this question, and I've thought about it a lot. I've actually talked with Chair Garrison and other members, and certainly with the Office of the Governor, so I do have some thoughts and ideas I'd love to sit down and talk with you all about. It requires, fortunately or unfortunately, because we receive federal funds, it requires public hearings, it requires making a formal proposal, working through the legislature. So it's not a small undertaking, it's an important undertaking. And I think that the time to evaluate that is here. So I do appreciate that. And that's something that our team has been working on for the past 2 years that I've been here.
Real quickly, you've got 1 minute left. Vice Chair Jacques.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Anton had a question. That's who I was
drawing the attention to. You would defer to Rep. Anton.
I will defer to Rep. Anton.
Representative Anton, yes, sir.
Thank you. Real quick, you mentioned $932,000 for the relief program. How is it divided up across the state as large as Florida?
Very quickly.
Mr. Chair, it uses an allocation funding source based on need. Thank you.
All right. Hey, thank you all. For Secretary, thank you. I appreciate it. I will tell you, just from this committee, I feel pretty good reading body language. And eye rolls, I think everyone on this committee would love to talk about ways we can get that 79 cents on the dollar pushed up to where less taxpayer dollars is going to admin and more is going to services for our seniors. I feel comfortable saying that as a team. So as you work through those issues, look forward to brainstorming about ways we can be more efficient with our dollars. So,
yes, sir.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
We appreciate
thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for getting here this morning and this meeting.